This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing.
You might not be thinking about this every time you pull out your wallet, but here's why retail sales are important. You're just plain fickle. Not you, the consumer you. A little bad weather or a bump in gas prices and bang, you cut back on your spending. And when 70% of the economy comes from you, well, economists start paying attention if retail sales get all wobbly. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Duke Executive MBA, developing leaders and accelerating careers around the world with 4 top-ranked executive MBA programs for working professionals. More at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. And by T. Rowe Price, mutual funds, IRAs, and college savings. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. 1-877-T-ROWE-PRICE or TRowePrice.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Thursday. It's the 12th of April today, and a caveat as we begin. Just as consumers are fickle, so are some of the numbers about consumers. Retail sales figures spring immediately to mind. March was good, we learned this morning. Overall, sales jumped 6% last month, thanks to warm weather and heavy Easter shopping. Predictions for April really weren't so hot. Walmart and Federated Department Stores both said they're not expecting great numbers this time next month. They're worried higher gas prices and fallout from the subprime mortgage scandal might keep shoppers home. Gap was having none of that negativity, though. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports the company may be recovering some of its long-lost luster.
Gap Inc. has been plagued by soaring competition and high staff turnover. Sales have been mostly flat or on the decline for the last several years, so a 6% rise in March caught analysts' attention. Retail analyst Bert Flickinger says the much-advertised boyfriend khakis and a line of clothing that funds aid programs in Africa are helping revive the original Gap brand.
Gap is not out of the woods, but at least it's put out the fire and can start to rebuild the business a bit.
But monthly sales are measured against the same month the previous year. Flickinger says it isn't hard to improve on last March when Gap sales fell 13%. Analyst Mark Montagna with research firm CL King says profit margins actually fell last month.
While you get some nice sales, the profit on each of the sales was lower than it was last year. So you may not actually get improved earnings for the month versus last year.
Still, some see glimmers of hope in Gap's turnaround efforts. The company's been closing stores to cut costs and reduce competition between its own brands, which include Old Navy and Banana Republic. Interim CEO Robert Fisher has outlined plans to recruit and retain creative talent. John Morris follows the company for Wachovia Securities.
I think we're going to see the company move from taking 2 steps back and 1 step forward to making 2 steps forward and 1 step back.
But can Gap take the next step to a profit? We'll find out next month when the company reports its first quarter earnings. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Shares of Menu Foods trade on the Toronto Stock Exchange under the ticker symbol MEW. Kind of cute after you learn it's this country's biggest supplier of pet foods. Less attractive, though, after you learn its chief financial officer sold half his shares in the company just before last month's big pet food recall. The Food and Drug Administration warned today contaminated pet food is still being found in some stores. In March, Menu recalled 60 million cans and pouches of wet pet food under various brand names. The company expanded its recall of cat food earlier this week. The contamination has been traced to wheat gluten imported from China. And at a congressional hearing today, senators heard calls for more inspections of pet food. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
The FDA says the bad wheat gluten was mixed with an industrial chemical, melamine, which may have been deliberately added as a protein enhancer. Neither pet food makers nor FDA inspectors had been screening for melamine. At today's hearing, the FDA's Stephen Sundlof said since the deaths of at least 16 pets, all imports of wheat gluten from China and Europe are now being inspected. But there's no telling how long that will last. Consider FDA's budget only allowed visits to less than a third of U.S. pet food factories over the past 3.5 years. That didn't satisfy Illinois Senator Richard Durbin.
Do you think that's an adequate inspection to protect the quality and wholesomeness and safety of pet food products?
Pet food is generally, and in fact traditionally, has been a very safe product. This is quite disturbing in this case because this is so unusual, and we're dealing with a substance that we had never encountered before.
With 140 million cats and dogs in this country, pet food is a $14 billion industry. But University of Tennessee veterinary medicine professor Claudia Kirk says there's no central regulator.
If it were mandatory for manufacturers to immediately report significant adverse events to a centralized regulatory agents, earlier investigative action, product withdrawals could occur.
A pet food representative said his industry has made a major commitment to work with the World Health Organization on international standards for pet food ingredients. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Everybody knows you've got to spend money to make money, especially if you're in a business nobody had ever heard of until just a couple of years ago, like maybe a high-tech way of making phone calls. Today, one of the companies that put VoIP on the map let loose what might be its death rattle. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has more.
You aren't going to hear Vonage's signature tune from its commercials so much anymore. The company says it's cutting back its marketing budget by $100 million, around 25%. 10% of Vonage's workforce is on the chopping block, too. You could blame today's cutbacks on the legal battle Vonage is locked in with Verizon, which says it stole some of its patents. But analyst Dave Lemlin of Instat Research says Vonage had problems even before a court slapped it with a $58 million fine for patent infringement.
They had explosive growth early on, but their growth rate has slowed. And a lot of that growth in VoIP has been taken up by the cable providers and even by the phone companies that now have voice over IP as part of their portfolios.
And as often happens with new technologies, the innovators wither as the big guns muscle their way in. Industry expert Jonathan Askin says Vonage's success is likely what caught the attention of rival Verizon.
I think Verizon was laying low, waiting for its moment to strike when it could do the most harm to its in-region competitor.
Vonage has had nothing but trouble since it went public last year. The stock has dialed down more than 80% since then. The next step in this ongoing saga takes place on April 24th, when an appeals court will rule whether Vonage can keep adding new subscribers. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Oil jumped 3% today, up almost $2 to $63.85 a barrel. Refiners are worried they won't have enough crude in 6 weeks or so when the summer driving season really gets going. Take that $63.85 with a grain of salt, though. It's what we're paying for a barrel of something called West Texas Intermediate, the U.S. benchmark. And it's a good deal cheaper right now than almost every other kind of crude out there, as much as $5 cheaper. North Sea Brent's what the rest of the world uses to price its oil. It closed at almost $69 a barrel today. Analysts are saying that might be a truer price for a barrel of crude. And then there's Dow. We told you a couple of days ago the chemical company's in buyout talks, $50 billion from a bunch of private equity firms. Well, it turns out that might not be the case. Dow announced today it's fired a top advisor and a senior official for trying to do a deal behind the company's back, however that might work out. Anyway, none of that mattered to investors. They picked up with their winning streak right where it was broken yesterday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. Ben Bernanke probably gets his economic indicators the old-fashioned way, reams of paper full of numbers telling him all he needs to know. We've got something more immediate we like to use. It's just around the corner here in our offices. We noticed this morning the price of corn chips in our vending machine went up 10 cents last time the guy came to restock. Sodas went up a dime, and those tiny little donuts, they were up almost 30 cents. We've called economist Dan Bossi to talk food prices. He runs the forecasting firm Ag Resource. Dan, thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome, Kai.
So our experience at the vending machine here down the hall is anecdotal, to be sure, but is it at all indicative of what's happening with food prices? Are they sort of rising just a bit?
Well, I think they are, Kai. I think as we look across the spectrum, for the first time in at least the past year, retailers are willing to pass along the higher costs of raw material. And by that, I'm saying, you know, whether it's corn and corn chips or starch made from corn or beef or pork or any of the other ingredients that are tied to agriculture, most of them are moving upwards. And so it's not only a phenomenon that you're seeing at your vending machine, it's something that's being seen throughout the world.
You know, that's interesting because pricing power is not something that manufacturers, whether they're in food or Jeeps, have really had for years now.
No, you really have to go back to the late 70s, early 80s before you had this kind of pricing power. And seems strangely enough, but a lot of this pricing power comes from the energy markets. If you go back and correlate rising energy prices to rising food prices, there seems to be a very strong relationship. And this was only, of course, emphasized by the Bush administration's christening of ethanol as being a way to get off Mideast oil. But on the sidelines, we're seeing a dramatic increase in caloric intake from Southeast Asia due to their rising disposable incomes. Not surprisingly, the first thing that someone would do in India or China when they make a few extra rubini would be to spend it on improving their diet. And that is what's going to really fuel, we think, in the future, higher food prices and something in the vicinity of 10 or 20% over the next couple of years.
Let me make sure I understand this. Rising Asian demand, as we all know, has led to higher prices for things like oil, commodities like steel. Now you're telling me that food prices here are going to go up because Asian demand is higher as well.
Well, that's right. I mean, when you look at the landmass of China, for instance, arable landmass, land that can be put into production, it's been shrinking based on their urban sprawl like it has been in many countries. So the Chinese have to rely very much so on rising yields to meet their demand. The Chinese have not been able to do it. They've seen their grain stocks fall dramatically in the last several years. And in fact, they've now been slowing exports. They do export a little bit of corn, but they've been, of course, massive buyers of things like soybean oil, soybeans, things that, of course, related to livestock and to their diet. The Chinese have a hog herd that's about 490 million head. That compares to we here in the United States at around 61 million head. So it's a dramatic increase, and all of those animals go to, of course, eating grain. And, of course, that has a phenomena of raising price.
Is this a one-time spike, or are we on the leading edge of a rising trend in food prices?
As long as energy prices stay higher and as long as this administration and much of the world wants to embrace a green bias, and it's hard to find a politician that doesn't want to be green, I think that that along with the rising disposable income in Southeast Asia, I'll call it the flattening of the world economic landscape, implies to us anyway that food prices will be moving upwards. But please understand that in a loaf of bread, there's maybe 4 cents of wheat. So if the wheat price doubled to 8 cents, you and I wouldn't notice it all that much. It's a combination of energy, including packaging and transportation, that causes the retailer and wholesaler to pass those price increases along.
Dan Bossi is an economist. He's also the president of Ag Resource. That's a forecasting firm in Chicago. Mr. Bossi, thanks a lot for your time.
You're very welcome.
Officials from Virginia's Fairfax County School District have a multi-million-dollar meeting in Washington tomorrow. It's a last-ditch effort to avoid fines over how the district tests its students. Fairfax is one of the wealthiest and most widely respected public school systems in the country, but it's run into trouble with the U.S. Department of Education over No Child Left Behind, which says you have to test virtually everybody, even kids still learning to speak or read English. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
The Fairfax County Public School System has a $2.2 billion budget and 164,000 students.
My name is Shravya. I was born in India.
Shravya Gadar came to the U.S. about 7 years ago and is one of more than 20,000 students in Fairfax who do not speak English at home.
I want to see your reading from yesterday on your desk.
Karen Niles is Shravya's 8th grade social studies teacher.
I'm teaching them to read as quickly as I can.
Still, Fairfax County has recently decided not to give some of its slowest English language learners a state language arts test that's mandated by No Child Left Behind. The federal law requires every state to test almost every student in grade level reading and math. These results count toward each school system's report card.
So we talked quite at length with my leadership team about what we should do.
Jack Dale is Fairfax County's school superintendent. He says some states offer exams in children's native languages. Virginia has chosen not to. So that leaves the district with a tough choice: comply with the federal law and get slammed for poor performance, or not test and risk possible federal fines. Indeed, federal officials say Fairfax's decision could cost its schools up to $17 million next year alone.
And we believe that what we should do is probably not test the kids then. They can't read English. They don't have the basic literacy levels that are necessary. So you won't have a valid test, so why bother putting a test in front of them?
Dale insists he's not trying to avoid testing students who won't do well. He says testing English language learners on grade-level English simply doesn't make sense. That attitude alarms Peter Zamora, an attorney at the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund.
Any student population that's not included risks being left out of the discussion around education reform.
Zamora believes that for years, public schools across the country haven't paid enough attention to foreign language students, and he says the consequences are devastating.
The dropout rate is around 70% for English language learners.
No Child Left Behind scores are broken down and analyzed by race, class, and language ability. Zamora sees that as the genius of the law.
So Fairfax, like many school districts and states even, would have a good average score. But once you look at individual student populations, you see very different outcomes based upon race and class and language ability.
If any one group of kids fails to meet state standards, the school districts are held accountable. Zamora believes these high-stakes tests, like No Child Left Behind, force school systems across the country to do better. He's worried if schools simply stop testing these kids, they'll also end up ignoring them.
By 2025, experts expect fully one quarter, 25% of our student population to be made up of English language learners. So at that point, we're really ignoring a huge proportion of our student population.
Zamora says that's not only bad for students learning English. Over time, it could have a dreadful effect on the American economy. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Coming up, the wealth tax that has the wealthy running away.
Germany cancelled wealth tax. Last year, Finland, and now the Swedish government. So France remains something like an exception.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow was actually down as much as 56 points today before it moved firmly positive for no obvious reason. The blue chip index closed the day 68 points higher at 12,552, a gain of 0.5%. The Nasdaq moved up 21 points to 2480, around 0.8%. The S&P 500 added 8 points, almost 0.2%, closed the day at 1447. A lesson today in why you should read past the business headlines. It sure sounded like grim news from Countrywide Financial. The nation's biggest home loan provider disclosed today that the share of its mortgage portfolio now facing foreclosure almost doubled last month from a year earlier. So which way do you think the stock moved? Anybody? It climbed by about 0.2%. Investors reading deeper into that story got the word from analysts that Countrywide is still in stronger shape than its rivals and in a better position to add market share. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program.
and buy the important new book, Speaking of Faith, by public radio host Krista Tippett, in bookstores everywhere now. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up tomorrow. The Commerce Department reports on international trade for February. The World Bank IMF spring meeting continues, and the G7 finance ministers meet in Washington. And it's Friday the 13th. There are two this year. The next one is in July. According to the Stress Management Center and Phobia Institute in Asheville, North Carolina, some folks won't even get out of bed or leave their homes. But Friday does launch the weekend, something to look forward to. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Ryssdal. A week of public pressure has cost Don Imus his job. CBS fired the radio host today over his racial slur against women on the Rutgers basketball team. As always, money talked. Advertisers were bailing out of the Imus broadcasts on CBS Radio and the television simulcast on MSNBC. Commentator Marcellus Andrews points out that in this case, it's black money.
I never thought I'd see the day when free market capitalism became the sword of racial justice. See, a funny thing's happened in America. Black people not only got mad at Imus, we got even. Imus forgot that advertisers want our dollars as much as they want those of the haters. I mean, Imus and hundreds of other white men whose radio and TV shows assault black kids every day with their racism for fun and profit rants. When Imus smeared millions of young black women, he included smart, sweet, chocolate-colored Leia Andrews, my niece in Denver who wants to play basketball at, yup, Rutgers. And when he did that, Staples, Procter & Gamble, and a host of other Imus sponsors that support the country's premier broadcast outlets realize they can't have it both ways. They can't have our support and the haters' support, too. Here's the bottom line. Whites still earn the lion's share of all income in the U.S., but it's dropping. From 88% in 1995 to 85% in 2005. The reality is that the fraction of all households that are white is falling, while black households are growing. So the black market is growing, the white market is shrinking as a fraction of the whole, and the Latino market is exploding. Racist ranters are playing to a declining market segment. Leia's mom and dad told her to turn her hatred of America's pleasure at abusing her into the energy to achieve. And she will with the help of a surprising new ally in the unfinished war against racism, money-hungry capitalists. Think of this as the black and green revolution of American capitalism. Black folks have enough money to impose a cash veto on numbskulls. Want to beat up on black folks for fun and profit? Fine. You have your fun while we hurt your profits.
Marcellus Andrews' latest book is called The Political Economy of Hope and Fear. If you have some thoughts for us, visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. French voters are in the middle of a presidential campaign. Next weekend brings the first round of balloting. And polls say the front runner is Nicolas Sarkozy. He's a tough law and order kind of guy. He's promising to cut taxes, too, a platform you might think would be a winner in one of the most highly taxed countries in the world. Au contraire, as John Lawrenson reports now from Paris.
Nicolas Sarkozy makes his entrance at a rally in Marseille to a song by Johnny Hallyday. The French, rather endearingly, still love the 63-year-old singer they've never stopped calling l'idole des jeunes, the teen idol. And when the presidential frontrunner, after kissing the cheeks of what feels like the entire population of Marseille, finally gets to Johnny, the old rocker, splendid in an ice cream white jacket, takes off his shades and the two men embrace to an enormous cheer. They've been friends since Sarkozy, as mayor of the rich Parisian suburb of Neuilly, married Hallyday to his latest wife. The French Elvis even joined Sarkozy's political party. Now, though, in order to stop paying four of his estimated $6 million annual income to the French taxman, Hallyday's fled to Switzerland.
Johnny Hallyday is not only a sex symbol, he's a social symbol.
Philippe Marigny, deputy head of the Senate Budget Committee, says two rich people a day are now doing a Johnny and escaping a wealth tax that has become an anachronism.
Germany, more than 10 years ago, cancelled wealth tax. Last year, Finland cancelled its own wealth tax. And now the Swedish government has decided to divide the rate by a factor two. So France remains something like an exception.
High earners in France can pay as much as 60% of their income in taxes, almost twice as much as in America. And Marigny says the wealth tax, which raises $5 billion a year, is counterproductive. He says it encourages people to move to lower tax countries like Switzerland, Belgium, and especially the UK. As a result of this exodus, France has lost some $30 billion of tax revenues this past decade. Some of the 300,000 French people who now live in London, greeting the presidential hopeful in the British capital.
À tous les expatriés qui sont malheureux de la situation de la France et de leur départ, je veux dire, revenez.
Come home, appeals Sarkozy. He's trying to tempt them back with a promise of tax cuts across the board with a 50% tax cap. This plays well to young expats in London, but many French people are outraged by the modest tax cuts that the current Chirac government has already implemented. Libération newspaper is even asking its readers to sign a Save Our Taxes petition. The front page headline, Vive l'impôt, Long Live Taxes. Jean-Michel Tenard is an editorialist at the paper.
Ça sert donc à faire vivre le vivre ensemble, le lien social en France.
He says taxes are about living together. They link the rich and the poor. They pay for public provision of education, transport, security and defence, all of which, he believes, are necessary for a civilised society. For Jean-Michel Tenard, Johnny Hallyday doesn't belong in the civilised society of France. Neither, apparently, do the tennis star Amélie Mauresmo, the singer Charles Aznavour, or the actor Alain Delon, all of whom have moved to Switzerland. Luckily, a few stars remain. Like who? Monsieur Tenard thinks for a moment. Michel Sardou?
Elle court, elle court, la maladie.
Even more entirely unknown abroad than Johnny, Sardou is becoming a citizen star, who said, wealth tax or no wealth tax, he's staying in France. In Paris, I'm John Laurenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, you've heard the stories about Merck's painkiller Vioxx. It's been linked to heart attacks and strokes. It's the subject of tens of thousands of lawsuits. And it appears Merck's alternative to it is no better. Merck wants approval to sell Arcoxia to treat osteoarthritis. But a scientist for the Food and Drug Administration said that drug could increase the risk of stroke and heart attacks itself. And a panel of federal health advisors agreed today it should not be approved in the U.S. It is, though, already on the market in 63 other countries. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 68 points, about a half a percent. The NASDAQ picked up 21 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 rose 8 points, 0.2%. Our editors include John Buckley, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek-Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Coming up tomorrow on the program, the best way to keep America competitive?
Green is the most strategic, capitalistic, and I think progressive ideology now for rebuilding America's future.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.